The Buddhas of the Three Times. At the heart of the refuge tree sit the Buddhas of the Three Times. Dipankara, a Buddha of the distant past, Shakyamuni, the Buddha of our own era, and Maitreya, the Buddha to be. Blazing with light at the centre of the tree, they represent the eternity of Buddhahood. The Buddha Shakyamuni did not invent the Dharma, but rediscovered it. Buddhahood, the principle of enlightenment, is beyond space and time. It is an eternal fact of life in all possible worlds. Buddhism thinks in terms of periods of time that are entirely beyond the grasp of the unenlightened mind. One of the traditional units of time in Buddhist thought is the kalpa. Suppose, the Buddha once said, there was a solid cube of rock, 4 leagues square, and at the end of every century a man was to stroke it once with a piece of the finest Benares muslin. The rock would be worn away before the kalpa came to an end. Dipankara lived many, many kalpas ago. As with time, space is incalculably vast. According to one simile, if a man were to take all the grains of sand in the river Ganges and were to deposit one grain of sand at the end of every period equaling in years the number of all those sand grains, after exhausting all the grains of sand in that river, he would be no closer to reaching the end of space than he was at the beginning. From the Mahayana perspective, this vast extent of space contains innumerable world systems, and each world system has its own Buddha. Each Buddha represents the intersection between eternal Buddhahood, which exists beyond space and time, and the historical or mythic world of space and time which that Buddha inhabits. The Buddhas of the Three Times, seated together at the centre of the refuge tree, symbolise the eternal presence of Buddhahood intersecting with our human world. They represent the constant possibility of change for the better and the prospect of unlimited self-transcendence at all times and in all places. Shakyamuni. Unlike the other Buddhas at the centre of the tree, Siddhartha Gautama, the man who went on to become the Buddha of our era, was clearly a historical figure. Recent research places his birth around 485 BCE in Lumbini, near Kapilavastu, in the area below the foothills of the Himalayas, which spans the current Nepalese border with India. His father, Suddhodana, was a member of the ruling oligarchy. Tradition later dubbed Siddhartha a prince and Suddhodana a king, but whatever his correct designation, we know that Suddhodana was rich and powerful and that the young Siddhartha led a privileged life. Upon his birth, a seer predicted that the young boy was destined for either political or spiritual empire. Suddhodana, wishing his son to choose the former, tried to attach him to the advantages of wealth and power, providing him with every available luxury and keeping him sheltered from the harsher facts of the world. He arranged for Siddhartha's marriage to a beautiful young woman, Yashodhara, and she bore him a son, Rahula. But Siddhartha experienced an acute sense of dissatisfaction. Whatever he had, whatever he did, there was always an aspect of himself that remained unfulfilled. Most of the people he met would have envied his privileged position. He had wealth, good looks and social status, a beautiful wife and a healthy heir. But he also saw deeply into the fundamental emptiness of his life, and his innate integrity would not allow him to pretend that everything was as it should be. What was the point of it all? Life seemed to be essentially meaningless, but he could not accept this and simply get on, as his companions did, with the usual daily round of the pursuit of power and pleasure. Riding in his chariot one day, he became aware for the first time of an old man and realized, as never before, the inevitable fact of old age. Similarly, he was confronted in turn by disease and by death. These experiences overwhelmed him. What was the point of living a life of ease and luxury when old age, disease and death were waiting quietly in the wings, biding their time before coming to claim him, his family and his friends? Finally, he saw a wandering mendicant, the sight of whom sowed in his mind the seed of the possibility that there was an alternative to the passive acceptance of old age, disease and death. At the same time, he saw that to embark on such a quest would require radical, even painful, action. His insight into the inevitability of old age, disease and death left him with an acute and ineradicable sense of the painful hollowness of upper-class Shakyan life. Ancestral duty demanded that he join in and get on with the business of warriorship and government. Yet at his core, he knew that a life which denied the fundamentals of reality was not for him. He had two stark options. He could deny reality, or he could deny family, luxury, and power. He chose the latter, and at the age of 29, simply left home, leaving behind his wife, child, family, power, and social status. He cut off his hair and beard, swapped his warrior garb for the rag robes of a religious mendicant, and began his quest for truth and liberation. It was an unsettled time. Rival kings were gradually absorbing and centralizing the earlier clan-oriented social structures. The old religion of the Vedas and its Brahminical priesthood was increasingly associated with these centralized governments, and a new class of religious practitioner was emerging. These were the wandering ascetics, who, dissatisfied with social conventions and the empty ritualism of established religion, gave up their homes and social positions to wander around, living on alms and seeking the truth. Siddhartha became a wanderer, and his demeanour struck those who met him with great force. Quote, "And as he, the Buddha, the one full of noble characteristics, walked about in search of food, he came in time to Rajagaha in Magadha. The king, Bimbisara, stood in his palace, and seeing the one possessing the noble characteristics, called out to his followers, 'Look carefully, friends. He is handsome, shapely, and of beautiful complexion. His gait is pleasing, with his eyes cast at only a little distance. With downcast eyes, he is mindful, and he does not seem to be from a low family. Send out the palace messengers to find out where he's going.'" End quote. So the king's men went out in search of the Buddha-to-be and sent someone to report back to the king. "Your Majesty," he said, "the monk has settled down on the east side of Mount Pandava. He's sitting there in his mountain lair like a lion or a tiger or a bull." The king went to meet Siddhartha. "You are only a young man, sir, a lad in the prime of your life. You are handsome and shapely. You appear to be a prince of noble birth. Adorning a splendid army, esteemed by a council of nobles, enjoy wealth which I can bestow upon you. However, can you please tell me what family you're from?" "King," came the answer, "not far from Himavant, the snowland, is a country called Kosala. The people of Kosala are rich and they are strong. They come from the race of the sun and their family name is Shakya. That was the people I left when I walked away from the wish and the longing for pleasure. I have seen the miseries of pleasure. I have seen the security involved in renouncing them. So now I will go. I will go into the struggle. This is, to my mind, delight. This is where my mind finds bliss. Siddhartha sought out the most famous spiritual teachers of his time, but soon surpassed them in spiritual attainment, and realizing that even the lofty heights to which they had led him didn't provide the answers he sought, he left each of them in turn and eventually continued his quest alone. It was commonly accepted at the time that one liberated the spirit by weakening the prison of the flesh. And for the next 6 years, Siddhartha engaged in extreme austerities. Quote, "Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. My backside became like a camel's hoof. The projections of my spine stood forth like corded beads. My ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. The gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. My scalp shriveled and withered as a green bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. My belly skin adhered to my backbone. Thus, if I touch my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. And if I touch my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. If I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair, rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed." End quote. Renowned for the extent of his asceticism, he soon attracted a following, but still he was not satisfied. 6 years after leaving home, he was no nearer to resolving the fundamental questions of existence. Realizing that his austerities had led him nowhere, Siddhartha had the moral courage to abandon his previous course. Having almost starved himself, he began to eat in moderation, and his former disciples, scandalized by this backsliding, left him in disgust. He was now completely alone, family, clan, reputation, and followers all abandoned. All his attempts to break through the veil of ignorance had failed. Desolate, he didn't know which way to turn next. Only one thing was certain: he would not abandon his quest. At this point, a memory rose to the surface of his mind. When he was quite young, sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree, he'd watched his father ploughing. Relaxed by the slow, steady rhythm of the ox team, sitting contentedly in the shade, he had spontaneously slipped into a concentrated meditative state. Might that be the way to enlightenment? In this state of acute existential solitude, his determination unshaken, Siddhartha sat down under a tree with this declaration: "Flesh may wither away, blood may dry up, but I shall not leave this seat until I gain enlightenment." All night he sat there in meditation. Seeing Siddhartha sitting determinedly in meditation, Mara, the evil one, shook with fright. Quote, "He had with him his three sons, Flurry, Gaiety, and Sullen Pride, and his three daughters, Discontent, Delight, and Thirst. These asked him why he was so disconcerted in his mind, and he replied to them with these words, "Look over there at that sage, clad in the armour of determination, with truth and spiritual virtue as his weapons, the arrows of his intellect drawn, ready to shoot. He has sat down with a firm intention of conquering my realm. No wonder that my mind is plunged in deep despondency. If he should succeed in overcoming me, and could proclaim to the world the way to final beatitude, then my realm would be empty today. But so far he has not yet won the eye of full knowledge. He is still within my sphere of influence. While there is time, I therefore will attempt to break his solemn purpose and throw myself against him like the rush of a swollen river breaking against the embankment." But Mara could achieve nothing against the Bodhisattva, and he and his army were defeated and fled in all directions, their elation gone, their toil rendered fruitless, their rocks, logs and trees scattered everywhere. They behaved like a hostile army whose commander had been slain in battle. So Mara, defeated, ran away together with his followers. The great seer, free from the dust of passion, victorious over darkness's gloom, had vanquished him. End quote. Siddhartha sat calmly beneath the tree, allowing his mind to become still. Gradually, all the different currents of his psyche began to flow together. His concentration increased, and his mind steadily became clearer and brighter. It was intensely pleasurable, but Siddhartha wasn't distracted by the pleasure, and letting it go, he entered states of increasingly profound equanimity. On and on he went, deepening and clarifying. Letting go of each preceding state, he entered deeper and deeper into meditative absorption. In the final watch of that full moon night in May, complete enlightenment finally dawned. Siddhartha Gautama became the Buddha. Quote, "And the moon, like a maiden's gentle smile, lit up the heavens, while a rain of sweet-scented flowers, filled with moisture, fell down on the earth from above." End quote. Siddhartha spent several weeks absorbing this profound experience. He pondered for some time whether or not he could make his discovery of enlightenment known to others. It was so subtle. To penetrate it required calm and great concentration. But people were so caught up in their petty desires, getting and spending, so attached to family, friends, wealth and reputation. Then, the legend goes, a celestial being appeared and begged him to teach, for there were some beings in the world with but little dust on their eyes, who were perishing for want of the teachings. With the eye of his imagination, the Buddha surveyed all the beings in the world. He saw them as a vast bed of lotus flowers. Some were sunk deep in the mire, others had raised their heads to the level of the water, and yet others had risen quite above the water. Though they had their roots in the mud, they were reaching up towards the light. There were beings who would understand what he had to say. The Buddha decided to teach. Leaving the place we now know as Bodh Gaya, he walked 100 or so miles to Sarnath, near the ancient city of Varanasi, where some of his former disciples were staying in a deer park. As he approached, they looked at each other in disgust. Here was the backslider Gautama, the former recluse. What did he want? They were certainly not going to receive him with respect. But as the Buddha approached, they were so taken with his calm, radiant demeanour that they could not but defer to him. These were stubborn men, hardened by years of asceticism, full-timers in the spiritual quest, They thought they'd heard it all. But the Buddha seemed to be approaching life from an entirely new dimension. There was something inexplicably different about him. They got down to debate, tough, straight talking. The discussions went on for several days. The Buddha's conviction and confidence was absolute. He had found the skillful middle way to enlightenment, a path leading between the extremes of hedonism and asceticism, nihilism and eternalism. Finally, the ascetic, Kaudinya, broke through. He saw what the Buddha was driving at and had the same kind of experience that the Buddha had under the tree at Bodh Gaya. His attachment to his own limited personality dropped away, and he too was now free from the bondage of craving. The Buddha was delighted. "Kaudinya knows," he exclaimed. "Kaudinya knows." What the Buddha had discovered could be made known. If Kaudinya could understand, then others could too. Humanity would benefit from these teachings. Over the next few days, the other ascetics also became enlightened. Then a young man called Yasha came by. Engaging the Buddha in discussion, he too became convinced of the truth of the teachings and brought his family and friends along to hear them. In this way, a new Sangha came into being. Soon there were 60 enlightened beings in the world, and the Buddha sent them out to teach for the welfare and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world. For the next 45 years, the Buddha wandered around northern India, either alone or accompanied by members of the community that was forming around him. As he wandered, he taught. Kings, courtesans, sweepers and householders, all kinds of people came to hear his Dharma. In the course of his life, the Buddha's fame as a teacher spread throughout northern India, an area of 50,000 square miles encompassing 7 different nations. He was known as Shakyamuni, the sage of the Shakya clan, and there was an immense interest in what he had to say. Enlightened at about 35, he lived until about 80, and all those 45 years were given over to teaching. Except in the rainy season, when he and whatever followers were with him retired into retreat, he walked the hot and dusty roads, through villages and cities, living on alms, taking only what was freely offered to him, and addressing himself to whoever wanted to hear what he had to say, irrespective of sex, caste, vocation or religion. Among his followers were 2 of the principal kings of the region, members of most of the leading republican families and some of the wealthiest merchants. During his travels, he came into close personal contact with wandering ascetics, peasants, artisans, shopkeepers and robbers. People of all castes poured into his sangha, where they lost their separate designations of caste and class and became simply followers of the Buddha. Wherever he could, the Buddha tried to help people to see things as they really are, responding to every situation out of the depths of his wisdom and compassion. He was affectionate and devoted to his disciples, frequently inquiring after their well-being and progress. When staying in a monastery, he paid daily visits to the sick ward. Once he himself attended a sick monk neglected by the others and made the comment that, "He who attends the sick attends me." The Buddha did not accept the religious significance of the caste system, a long-established institution in India, and recognized the religious potential of men and women of all ranks. Quote, "So what of all these titles, names and races? They are merely worldly conventions. They have come into being by common consent. This false belief has been deeply ingrained in the minds of the ignorant for a long time, and still these ignorant ones say to us, one becomes a Brahmin by birth. On the contrary, no one is born a Brahmin, no one is born a non-Brahmin. A Brahmin is a Brahmin because of what he does. A Brahmin is as a result of self-restraint, wholesome living and self-control. This is the essence of Brahmin. End quote. He appreciated both natural and physical beauty. On several occasions, he was moved aesthetically as he told Ananda how delightful certain places were to him. He once told his monks that if they had not seen the devas of the Tarvatinsa heaven, they should look at the handsome lichavis, beautifully and elegantly dressed in assorted colours. The Buddha loved peace and quiet. Even the followers of other teachers respected his wishes in this regard, silencing their discussions on his approach. He would not allow noisy monks to live near him, and he often spent long periods in solitude, having one monk bring him his meals. King Pasenadi. King Pasenadi could not understand how the Buddha maintained such order in the Sangha when he, a king, with the power to inflict punishment, could not maintain it so well in his court. The Buddha told him that he kept order and discipline on the basis of the mutual love, affection and respect that exists between teacher and pupil. He had a quiet and ironic sense of humour. A conceited Brahmin, who was in the habit of denigrating others, questioned him as to the qualities of a true Brahmin. In a list of such high qualities as freedom from evil and purity of heart, the Buddha gently included not denigrating others. The Buddha's courage was shown on a number of occasions. He went out, single and unarmed, to confront the serial killer, Angulimala. When his cousin Devadatta launched various plots against his life, the Buddha refused his followers' offer of a bodyguard. At the age of 80, his body worn out and racked with pain, the Buddha made one final teaching tour, giving all his friends and followers one last chance to ask any questions about the teaching. To the end, he was completely aware and concerned only for the welfare of others. A wanderer called Subhadra came to see him on his deathbed, and Ananda, the Buddha's companion, turned him away, not wishing the Buddha to be disturbed at such a time. But the Buddha insisted on talking with him, and Subhadra, soon convinced of the truth of the Dharma, joined the Sangha. Then the Buddha asked if any of the assembled Sangha had any doubts or questions about his teaching. With typical thoughtfulness, he allowed that those who were too embarrassed to ask for themselves might do so through a friend. The answer was a resounding silence. The Buddha had made the Dharma perfectly clear. Seeing this, he gave a final exhortation to his followers. All conditioned things are impermanent. With mindfulness, strive. And with that, he entered a state of deep meditation and passed away. Dipankara. Over the course of aeons, our own world system has seen a large number of Buddhas. The Dharma dies out for a time, and a Buddha arises who rediscovers it. They in turn teach the Dharma, which lasts for a time and dies out. Then another Buddha arises and rediscovers it. The Buddha Dipankara, whose name means kindler of lights, was, according to legend, the first in a line of 24 Buddhas who preceded Shakyamuni, the Buddha of the present age. He played a crucial part in Shakyamuni's story inasmuch as it was in his presence that the Bodhisattva who eventually went on to become Shakyamuni declared his intention to achieve full enlightenment. Legendary accounts of the Buddha Dipankara's life broadly follow the pattern we are familiar with from the life of Shakyamuni. His father was a king. He left home and practiced austerities, gained enlightenment under a Bodhi tree, and taught for many years. In some of the legends, he is said, unlike the Buddha of our own era, to have been enormously tall, 80 cubits high according to some Pali sources. He lived for 100,000 years and was always attended by an assembly of 84,000 arhants. When he died, he was entombed in a stupa 36 yojanas high. According to Pali tradition, many eons ago, the Buddha-to-be was known as Sumedha. He was a very rich Brahmin from Amaravati. But he left the world and went forth to become an ascetic high in the Himalayas. While visiting a town, he came upon a crowd of people decorating the road upon which the Buddha Dipankara was due to pass. Sumedha joined in the work, but before he was able to finish, the Buddha arrived. Seeing that the Buddha would have to walk over rough ground, Sumedha, in great devotion, lay down in a rut so that the Buddha might walk over him. At that moment, his faith overflowed and he resolved that one day he too would become a Buddha. Dipankara, looking into the future with his supernormal powers, saw that Sumedha's wish would come true and that one day far in the future, when he had practiced as a bodhisattva for many aeons, he would eventually become the Buddha Shakyamuni, and he proclaimed this fact to the assembled multitude. The Mahavastu has a slightly different account. The young Brahmin Megha, quote, decided to go to the royal city Dipavati in order to see the city of a universal monarch. Say that again. Decided to go to the royal city Dipavati in order to see the city of a universal monarch made of the seven precious things and delightful to behold. When he entered the city, he saw that it was in festive array. He wondered to himself, what holiday do we have here today? Or what dramatic performance? Or what festival? And as he went on, he looked for someone he could question. Just then, a young Brahmin girl came along, attractive, good-looking, reliable, gentle and modest. She held a water jug and seven lotus flowers in her hand. Megha asked her, is there a festival in the city today? She replied with these verses. You cannot, young man, be a native of this place, a stranger from another city you must be. You do not know that there is coming to this town the benefactor of the world, the bringer of the light. Dipankara, the leader of the world, the son of King Archimat. He, a greatly famous Buddha, is drawing near. To honour him, this city is decked in gay and festive garb. Megha asked her, how much did you pay for those seven lotus flowers? She replied, five of them I bought for 500 coins. Two were given to me by a friend. Megha said to her, I will give you 500 coins. You then give me those five lotuses, and with them I shall worship Dipankara the Lord. You can honour him with the remaining two. She replied, you can have those five lotuses, but only on condition that for all future time you take me for your wife. Wherever you may be reborn, there I shall be your wife, and you my husband. Megha replied, my heart is set upon supreme enlightenment. How can I think of marriage? End quote. The girl acquiesced, but Megha decided to marry her anyway. It was clearly a case of mutual love at first sight. But Megha was nonetheless not distracted from his desire to honour the Buddha. when he saw the Buddha Dipankara, Magga's body, quote, was flooded with great joy and gladness, and a sublime decision arose in his mind. He threw himself down at the feet of Dipankara, the Lord, and aroused within himself the following thought, Ah, may I too at some future period become a Tathagata with all the attributes of a perfect Buddha, as this Lord Dipankara is just now. May I too turn the wheel of the highest Dharma, as this Lord Dipankara does just now. Having crossed, may I lead others across. Set free, may I free others. Comforted, may I comfort others, as does this Lord Dipankara. May I become like him, for the weal and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the sake of a great multitude of living beings, for their weal and happiness, be they gods or men. And Dipankara, aware of Magga's deep devotion and his great store of merit, predicted that in the future, after an immeasurable, incalculable kalpa, he too would become a Buddha. Because of the part he played in the former life of the Buddha Shakyamuni, Dipankara is widely considered to be the most important of all the Buddhas of the past. Together with Shakyamuni and Maitreya, he is one of the Buddhas of the three times, past, present, and future. Maitreya. In the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha tells some of his followers at Magadha about Metteya, the friendly one, the Buddha to be. Quote, and in that time of the people with an 80,000 year lifespan, I'll start that again. Quote, and in that time of the people with an 80,000 year lifespan, there will arise in the world a blessed Lord, an arahant, fully enlightened Buddha named Metteya, endowed with wisdom and conduct, a welfarer, knower of the worlds, incomparable trainer of men to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed, just as I am now. He will thoroughly know by his own super knowledge and proclaim this universe with its devas, maras and brahmas, its ascetics and brahmins, and this generation with its princes and people, just as I do now. He will teach the Dhamma, lovely in its beginning, lovely in its middle, lovely in its ending, in the spirit and in the letter, and proclaim, just as I do now, the holy life in its fullness and purity. He will be attended by a company of thousands of monks, just as I am attended by a company of hundreds. End quote. Maitreya is currently residing in the Tushita Devaloka, the heaven of the contented ones, which is the abode of all the bodhisattvas who are awaiting the right moment for their final rebirth, when they will finally sever the bonds of craving and attain to Buddhahood. Maitreya is the only celestial being accepted as such by both the Theravada and Mahayana traditions. It's not uncommon for Theravadins to pray to be reborn when he appears and then to become monks so as to be able to proceed to enlightenment under his tutelage. While in the Mahayana, Maitreya's coming was sometimes seen to precede a kind of Buddhist millennium when nothing but skillfulness will prevail. For example, in the Maitreya Vyakarana, I'll say that again, Maitreya Vyakarana. For example, in the Maitreya Vyakarana, the prophecy concerning Maitreya, Shariputra asks the Buddha Shakyamuni to tell the assembly about the Buddha to be. The Buddha replies, quote, At that time, the ocean will lose much of its water, and there will be much less of it than now. In consequence, a world ruler will have no difficulties in passing across it. India, this island of Jambu, will be quite flat everywhere. It will measure 10,000 leagues, and all men will have the privilege of living on it. It will have innumerable inhabitants, who will commit no crimes or evil deeds, but will take pleasure in doing good. The soil will then be free from thorns, and covered with a fresh green growth of grass. When one jumps on it, it gives way and becomes soft like the leaves of the cotton tree. It has a delicate scent. Say that again. It has a delicious scent, and tasty rice grows on it without any work. Rich silken and other fabrics of various colours shoot forth from the trees. The trees will bear leaves, flowers and fruit simultaneously. They are as high as the voice can reach, and they last for 8 myriads of years. Human beings are then without any blemishes. Moral offences are unknown among them, and they are full of zest and joy. Their bodies are very large, and their skin has a fine hue. The city of Ketumati will at that time be the capital. In it will reside the world ruler, Shankar by name, who will rule over the earth up to the confines of the ocean. And he will make the Dharma prevail. He will be a great hero, raised to his station by the force of hundreds of meritorious deeds. End quote. Because the world has now been made receptive to his teaching, Maitreya will then leave the Tushita heaven and take his last rebirth. Quote, as soon as he is born, he will walk 7 steps forward, and where he puts down his feet, a jewel or a lotus will spring up. He will raise his eyes to the 10 directions and will speak these words, "This is my last birth. There will be no rebirth after this one. Never will I come back here, but, all pure, I shall win Nirvana." As Maitreya grows up, the Dharma will increasingly take possession of him, and he will reflect that all that lives is bound to suffer. He will have a heavenly voice which reaches far. His skin will have a golden hue. A great splendour will radiate from his body, and he will win his enlightenment the very same day that he has gone forth into the homeless life. And then, a supreme sage, he will, with a perfect voice, preach the true Dharma. Under Maitreya's guidance, hundreds of thousands of living beings shall enter upon a religious life. Then, Shakra, the king of the gods, turned to the Buddha Shakyamuni and praised him. As a result of Maitreya's teaching, he proclaimed, "Gods, men and other beings will lose their doubts and their cravings will be cut off." Quote, "Free from all misery, they will manage to cross the ocean of becoming, and as a result of Maitreya's teaching, they will lead a holy life. No longer will they regard anything as their own. They will have no possessions, no gold or silver, no home, no relatives. But they will lead a holy life of chastity under Maitreya's guidance. They will have torn the net of the passions. They will manage to enter into the trances, and theirs will be an abundance of joy and happiness, for they will lead a holy life under Maitreya's guidance. For 60,000 years, Maitreya, the best of men, will preach the true Dharma, which is compassionate towards all living beings. And when he is disciplined in his true Dharma, hundreds and hundreds of millions of living beings, then that leader will at last enter Nirvana. And after the great sage has entered Nirvana, his true Dharma still endures for another 10,000 years. Raise therefore your thoughts in faith to Shakyamuni, the conqueror, for then you shall see Maitreya, the perfect Buddha, the best of men. Whose soul could be so dark that it would not be lit up with a serene faith when he hears these wonderful things, so potent of future good? Those, therefore, who long for spiritual greatness, let them show respect to the true Dharma. Let them be mindful of the religion of the Buddhas. End quote. In The Way of the White Clouds, Lama Govinda writes very movingly about a statue of Maitreya he encountered at Yi Ga Cho Ling, the Gompa near Darjeeling, where Dado Rinpoche was later to serve as abbot. Quote, "Whenever I happened to wake up during the night, I beheld the benign features of Buddha Maitreya's golden face, which seemed to float high above the shadowy forms that filled the temple in the dim light of the eternal lamp. And in the golden, softly radiating face, the large, deep blue eyes seemed to be filled with supernatural life, and I felt their glance resting upon me with infinite tenderness." End quote. That statue had been placed there by Lama Govinda's teacher, the great Tomo Geshe Rinpoche, who was renowned for conjuring up visions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for people to see. Tomo Geshe had a strong connection with the Buddha Maitreya and urged his followers to turn their feelings for Maitreya to a spiritually practical account. Quote, "He erected statues of Maitreya in many other places and made the followers of the Buddha Dharma conscious of the fact that it was not sufficient to bask in the glories of the past, but that one must take active part in the shaping of the future and thus make it possible for the coming Buddha to appear in this world by preparing our minds for his reception." End quote. Iconographically, Maitreya is usually golden in colour and often appears in the posture of royal ease. In his left hand he holds a lotus with a stupa rising out of it. He may also be shown holding a golden Dharma chakra, or wheel of the Dharma, or a sacred vase filled with the nectar of the Dharma, which he will one day pour over the world. He may also be shown in the Bhadrasana pose, which is virtually unique in Buddhist iconography. He sits on a throne, his feet flat on the ground before him. This indicates that he's readying himself to step down into our world. In this pose, he holds one hand to his cheek with three fingers, representing the three jewels, extended. And he gazes with infinite compassion upon the world that he will one day light up with the radiance of his Dharma teaching. Maitreya stands for the infinite compassion of the Bodhisattva. He could remain there at ease in the Tushita Devaloka, but one day he will descend to our plane of existence to spread the Dharma for the sake of a suffering world. He stands, therefore, as a sign of continuous optimism. Buddhas will appear and reappear wherever there are unenlightened beings to be saved. End of chapter.